Okay, we want to start with our class memory verse. Hopefully you get this thing in your head by now. Are they not all ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those who are to inherit salvation? So that's the purpose of angels. They were part of the servant class that God designed. They actually existed before humanity, just a few days before. And their purpose was to help us out. But as we have already talked in our study, it all went wrong there in the Garden of Eden. And we end up with a significant minority of that supernatural serving class. They really hate us. They don't like us a bit. We suspect it has something to do with the fact that we, as a people, were made in the image and likeness of God, and they were expected to treat us as such, and Satan was pretty much the gang leader that didn't want to do it that way. And so that seems to be the way everything started. The next thing, the next big thing that we were talking about was the big problem in Genesis chapter 6. We spent a lot of our time on that last week. The fallen angel abduction of women, as it's recorded there. I went out and found a literal translation for you. This is Young's literal translation, to help you see that the word wife doesn't actually appear in the context. So here it goes. It cometh to pass that mankind have begun to multiply on the face of the ground, and daughters have been born to them, and sons of God see the daughters of men, that they are fair. The word actually means good, and I think it's the idea of usable. And they take to themselves women of all whom they have chosen. That is literally what it says in the text. It doesn't say anything about marriage. It actually sounds more like abduction wording to me. And so that is what kicked off the Genesis 6 crisis. Now, we have two passages in the New Testament that talk about this event. We dealt with that last week. As means of review, I want to zero in on another aspect of that, because those passages were focusing upon the pursuit of, quote, strange flesh. Okay? Look at the 2 Peter passage first. 2 Peter chapter 2, and it's verse number 4 is where the context begins. The larger context of the book of 2 Peter is that Peter is talking about false teachers and the trouble they're causing in the church. And so he says, if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into Tartarus, remember I told you that's the actual wording there, and you should have a footnote that notes that, committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment, if he did not spare the ancient world, which is actually associated with the Genesis chapter 6 story, but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, if by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, he condemned them to extinction, making them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly. So that's the three examples of bad choices that brought judgment. Okay? But then he gets to his, he continues, he says, if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked, for as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. So that's actually, you know, the Sodom and Gomorrah story. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials or troubles and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. and especially those who indulge or pursue in the lust of defiling passion and despise authority. So we have a citation in this context that part of the problem is pursuing somebody or someone that they should not be pursuing for their own purposes, which actually was going on in Peter's day, and he was complaining about that and how God was going to judge that. The Jude passage is a little bit more precise in the wording on this. Jude's written a few years later, after Peter's dead, uses the framework of 2 Peter chapter 2 in particular. But Jude, there's only one chapter, so go to verse number 6. And the angels who did not stay within their own position of authority, so they didn't stay where they belonged, where they'd been assigned, but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities were likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire. The literal is pursued other flesh or strange flesh, as some of our English Bible versions went with. And they serve as an example by undergoing a punishment of eternal fire. So you remember the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. The fuller story that we get from the book of Ezekiel is that Sodom and Gomorrah, the five cities that included those two, were filthy rich. I mean, they'd made a lot of money. They were fat and happy, and they really didn't want to help anybody else out. They only wanted to make more money for themselves. And so when judgment came upon them, it came in the form of two angels showing up to rescue the relative of Abraham at Abraham's request. And the guy didn't want to leave. And so they basically had to force him to leave. But in the process, do you remember what happened between Lot and the locals? What did he have to do? Yeah. He was having to protect the angels because the locals were like, hey, new guys in town, let's see how they feel in our little sexual fantasies. So that is paralleled in the Jude passage with the idea of what the fallen angels were doing. They were going after persons that they shouldn't have been going after to utilize them for their own purposes. That's the point. And so that is why all of those places were judged by God very severely. Why that group of fallen angels, because it wasn't all the fallen angels, it was a group of them. They ended up being kicked into Tartarus, which, think of it as kind of like the most secure part of the local jail that these angels are being kept in until they get sent to the permanent penitentiary called hell. So they're kept in very tight confinement. So they're there because they were messing around with human women when they shouldn't have been. Now, I told you last week that I was taught as a little kid when this story in Genesis 6 did come up, which it was not very often talked about. But then in college, Bible college, we were taught that the daughters of men was a reference to the godly line of Seth, and that the the sons of God was a reference to the godly line of Seth, and that the daughters of men was a reference to the ungodly line of Cain. Now, last week I took you to the very place where that first was suggested, and it was more than 100 years after the New Testament. So it's definitely not Bible teaching. It is post-Bible teaching. And the guy that was doing it even acknowledged the original understanding of the church and of the Jewish people, that this was literally fallen angels messing around with human women. So when I was in college, one of the objections that was made to understanding the Bible passage as being literal, when it says that that was what was going on, was angels don't marry. And they would go to this passage in the New Testament. Matthew 22 is the one I'm throwing up on the screen, but there is a parallel that's almost the exact same wording in Mark 12. The context is that Jesus is being given this wild hypothetical by Sadducees who don't believe in supernatural things. They don't believe in the resurrection from the dead. They don't believe in any of that stuff. But they give this hypothetical to Jesus. Well, what if a woman marries a man and then he dies without them having a kid, and then his brother by the law has to marry her, and then he dies, they still don't have a kid, and then another brother dies after marrying her, they don't have kids, and there's a total of 7 brothers, all of them marry her, none of them have kids with her. So Jesus, in this resurrection from the dead that you guys believe in, who's she going to be married to? Because she had all of them as husbands. And so Jesus' response is, you're wrong, because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. How many of you are familiar with that passage? Right? So that was thrown out as evidence. Angels don't marry, therefore Genesis chapter 6 can't be about angels marrying. Now, you already know that I say it's not about marrying in Genesis chapter 6. The word marry is not found there. But there's another passage that explains this meaning of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke. If you're not aware, Luke, when he wrote, he was not just simply writing down the words of Jesus as he heard it from witnesses. He tells Theophilus, one of the things I'm doing for you is to help you understand what Jesus was saying. So Dr. Luke very often gives a paraphrase or a commentary expansion of what Jesus was saying. So Luke is always a good one to go to if you're looking at Matthew and Mark and go, I wonder what he meant by those words. Here's Luke's words. Jesus said to them, "The sons of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy to attain to that age and to the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage." We already saw that from Matthew, right? But look at the next part. "For they cannot die anymore because they are equal to angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection." So according to Dr. Luke, Jesus' actual point is that angels don't die. Angels don't die, and therefore they didn't need to reproduce themselves. They were a set number from the beginning of creation. And that once we've all attained to the resurrection from the dead, the set number of humans will have come into existence. There will be no more humans made after that point. When Jesus comes back and the trumpet is sounded and all the dead are back in place, and all the resurrection is taking place. There's no reason for any additional births, because we all live forever at that point, and the number has been reached. That's the point that Jesus was trying to make in response to the Sadducees. It really isn't about angels don't marry. Although, again, Genesis chapter 6 isn't about angels marrying. It's about them taking women, whomever they felt like, and using them for their own purposes. Questions up to this point? Yes, that is another interesting thing that you see there. Luke understands that angels are also called sons of God. And we are also called sons of God because of our creation in his image and likeness, but also because when we've been redeemed, that's refreshed that relationship. So yes, we get called sons of God as well. Why do I think that there's a mix-up in the translation? I don't think it's so much a mix-up. It's Bible study. Bible study is two stages, really. And that is when we... first step is we have to take it from the language it was originally in and understand it in that context. Which is why there's a lot of us that have to go and learn those languages and then spend a lot of time studying those languages and the culture and all that context. And then, having understood that, we have to then apply it, make sense of it in our own context. And so that is a bit of an art. And some people disagree on exactly how to kind of carry out that art. And so that's why you have scholarly debates on things like this. Which, you know, I've actually had conversations with people who are quite adamant that about the sons of God were the sons of Seth, and the daughters of men were the sons of Cain. And they're like, that's definitely what we learned, and that's definitely what it means. And I'm like, no. I think if you expand your research, you'll find out that that's not the case. And that idea didn't even come up until after the church era had gotten started. And so I think that's a very persuasive argument, is that we know that Peter and Jude both reference Genesis chapter 6 in their writings about angels messing around with women. It's pretty clear that they accepted that as the norm. If those guys believed it, and we know one of them is an apostle, inspired by God, that's what we should go with.
When Jesus goes back and the people are equal to the angels.
Yeah.
Women, sons of God?
Say that again?
Women?
Yeah, I mean, there's this equality that he's talking about. In when we are the resurrected saints, we have gotten back to where we were in the garden before sin. Perfect equality, perfectly on the same page. We don't need this tiered system anymore of, you know, okay, we have a disagreement here. Somebody has to have the tie-breaking vote. That's kind of what you're talking about a little bit, right? No, we're going to be in a perfect world again. So we're not going to have all of that difficult problems. The big point, though, was that we're equal to angels in that we're not going to die, so we don't need to we don't need to procreate ourselves. We don't need to make more of us. We've already done that. Been there, done that. Don't need it anymore. Which tells me, just kind of a side thing, which tells me that more than likely, even if Adam and Eve had not sinned and humanity had just started procreating and spreading out in their perfect world and their perfect lives, eventually, it seems to me, God would have gotten to the point and said, okay, that's enough. There's enough of you. We're done. We don't need to keep reproducing here anymore. We've reached the number. Just my speculation on that, okay? Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
That they
were locked up in prison. Yes. The fallen angels, and it's only the ones that were involved in the Genesis 6 incident. Those guys have never been free since they got kicked into that prison. Because we've got other fallen angels that are still messing around. The demonic world is still playing their games.
But the ones that left Lucifer,
right, but Lucifer wasn't involved in the Genesis 6 thing.
Right.
The Genesis 6 thing is only a limited number of the fallen angels. Okay? Does that make sense?
So the ones that left Lucifer wandered.
Yeah, they're still causing trouble. Now, the guys that caused the trouble in Genesis 6, they went with Lucifer. They went with Satan. But apparently they had other things in their mind, trying to reproduce themselves, maybe pump up the number of those that will follow them, and that didn't go so well for them. So they got themselves in trouble. Now, that brings us then to Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and we talked about that word last week. It means fallen ones. And also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man and they bore children to them, these were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. Now, we talked about this idea that before the flood, these, and we're going to use the word hybrid because that's a good technical word here. It's when two different parents are involved in an offspring, right? So when you've got these fallen angels monkeying around with the gene code of these human women that they've taken, you end up with a hybrid. We don't know how the details worked on that. Okay? But they ended up causing the production of these Nephilim, which are the mighty men of old, the men of renown. You remember back in high school when we all took Greek mythology, right? And Roman mythology. Do you remember the demigods? Demigods? What's the definition of a demigod?
Half human, half God.
They were half human, half God. That's really the same thing we're talking about here. Because the Greek and the Roman mythology had the same ideas. That the gods, in this case for our purposes, the fallen angels, the god wannabes, they monkeyed around in the human world and ended up spinning off these demigods. Now, they're the big story people, right? Hercules, Perseus, right? All these different characters, they were not human, they were superhuman. That's what this passage is kind of talking about as well, is that the Jewish people also understood there were these stories about these guys that were more than human, and they did things that were shocking and surprising. Now, we know that the flood was brought on in large part because of this garbage that was going on. Well, this passage says that they were the Nephilim, the fallen ones, the hybrids, were on the earth in those days, that is, before the flood. But what does that say in red there? and also afterward, after the flood, we have a similar problem. And so Josephus talks about these hybrids in this way, and we saw the very first part of this quote last week, that these men did what resembled the acts of those whom the Grecians called giants. Remember, giants is a Greek word, gigantes. It means earth-born, born upon the earth. It's the idea of, the combo between the heavenly beings and the earthly beings, okay? Some of them were very large, and that's why we associate the word giant with large. That's the reason why. Gigantes just by itself doesn't mean large. But Noah, I love this part of the story. Noah was very uneasy at what they did, and being displeased at their conduct, persuaded them to change their dispositions, or we should say tried, their acts for the better. But seeing that they did not yield to him, but were slaves to their wicked pleasures, he was afraid that they would kill him, together with his wife and children, and those they had married, so he departed out of their land. Now that's the Jewish tradition in the first century by Josephus. And of course, what follows up shortly after that in the story? A flood wipes them all out. Only Noah and his family survive because they're the only righteous ones left. Here's your new vocabulary word for tonight because of what's about to come up in our Bible reading. Rephaim. Everybody say it. Rephaim. Hopefully you know by now, im, I-M, at the end of a word, is plural. So this is a plural word. It's formed from a verb that means to enliven or to heal. And you see it used in the healing way several different times in the scripture. But the part that we're more interested in is the part about the liveliness here. Okay? That they've got a lot of energy. That seems to be the idea that's coming through. All right, I messed myself up by hitting the wrong button. I'll be right back. All right, so in the Greek Old Testament, the word is gigantes, giants, okay? Literally meaning earthborn. So your vocabulary from the scripture, Rephaim, or perhaps your passage will say giants. Those would be one or the other. Passage I want you to go to, Genesis chapter 14. Only three verses, and probably verses you never really thought of too much because they got a lot of words in it that you don't like to pronounce because there's a lot of Hebrew words. Let's just read it first, and then I'll go back and talk about it. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Shava Kiriathaim, and the Horites in their hill country of Seir, as far as El Paran on the border of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to Inmashpat, that is to Kadesh, and defeated all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who were dwelling in Hazazon Tamar. Yeah, right. Okay, thank you. That's, that really is helping me in my devotional time, right? But here's the deal. This is happening right around 2100 BC is the time of Abraham. And this is the description of an invasion of the lower Middle East when Abraham is there. His nephew, Lot, gets kidnapped by this invading force. And that is why Abraham comes into this story. But here's your map of the lower Middle East. If you look at the top there on the left corner, or top left, you see the little harp-shaped Sea of Galilee. Then you see down below the longer Dead Sea. Got all that? That's the Holy Land. This invading army came from the north along the eastern side of that area because they were trying to go down and loop around the area that they wanted to take control back on, which was the lower portion of the Dead Sea zone. That's where Sodom and Gomorrah and the other three cities were located. Filthy rich, and the Mesopotamians had already put them under their boot and made them pay them taxes. But they decided to rebel and not pay their taxes. So that's what brought this invading army down here to bring those people back underneath their control. But as they were making their way down that direction, they ran into giants, and they had to deal with them. The first group that they ran into, this is verse number 5 again, they defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Garnaim. That's actually up at the top of our map there, right there by the red line as it's coming into the map, up by the Sea of Galilee. They ran into a big cluster of giants. Then they ran into some more of Zuzim, this time in Ham, which is about halfway down the Jordan Valley area. Another cluster of giants. These guys they've got a different name. I think it has something to do with their long necks or something like that. But it would appear that you've got different zones of different giant groups. Now, what does it tell us? It tells us that apparently, by this time after the flood, and we're talking about 3,000 years later, apparently some fallen angels have been monkeying around again. And they've started reproducing their little hybrid project. This time they seem to be doing it a little bit more carefully. My suggestion to you, and I already mentioned this last week, is that they may have this time secured the cooperation of the humans. Because it's likely that violating the free will of humans the first time is what got them in trouble. Because if humans make up their own choices, that's something God let them do, even if it's a bad choice. But if they are grabbed and forced against their will to do something, that is a violation that God steps in on. Yes? Sodom and Gomorrah is the little green blob down there, and they seem to radiate outward from the Sodom and Gomorrah area. Yes.
And that would make sense if the people in Sodom and Gomorrah were kind of sleeping around.
Exactly. The people in Sodom and Gomorrah have got issues with morality. They seem to me almost like ground zero for bad human choices on a large scale. And you may remember last week that one of the things that the Jewish tradition says about the fallen angels is that they were trying to teach humans to do things against God. And so I believe that what we actually are seeing represented here on the map is that the Sodom and Gomorrah area was probably the area where the fallen angels were doing a lot of their heavy-duty work. And part of that work ended up producing some of these gigantes, these giants, these hybrids. And, of course, they kind of spread around on the property, and they didn't like to let people come through and cause trouble. And so that's why the Mesopotamians fought them on their way through. First up in the north, then in the middle. We keep on reading. It says that they next defeated the Emim in Shaawah Kiriathayim. That's just to the east or the right of the Dead Sea. And then from there, they go down south of the Dead Sea area. They mix it up with the Horites. A Horite has to do with living in caves. Remember anything about giant stories with giants living in caves? And then they end up circling around and then coming back and taking the Sodom and Gomorrah area. So that's our first post-flood reference to giants, and it is a big deal. These Mesopotamians have to fight their way through several different groups of giants before they feel secure enough to take back control of the Sodom and Gomorrah area. And then they kidnap Lot, and that was a really bad choice. And Abraham comes after him. And if Abraham comes after you, that means God's coming after you, and you're in trouble. Okay? And so that's the Abraham story on all of this.
So all those, the Raphaim, the Zuzim, the Emim,
yep,
the Amalekites.
The Amalekites are not considered a giant race. The others are.
Amorites,
sorry. They aren't as well. But the others were considered giant races. They are listed as giant races in other places. In fact, the next passage that we're going to go to mentions them again. Go to Deuteronomy this time. Deuteronomy chapter number 2. This is talking about events that happened while Israel was in Egypt. So between 1700 and 1500 BC. And it's a story about what some other groups did to those same giants, because they didn't wipe them out. The Mesopotamians didn't wipe them out. They just beat them up and then moved on. Eventually, though, the human populations did try to wipe these guys out. So verse number 10, and if you got an English Bible that starts with a parenthesis there, there's a reason why, because this is a parenthetical thought. This is parenthetical information, because Moses is talking about the neighboring areas around the Promised Land. Verse 10, the Emim formerly lived there, a people great and many and tall as the Anakim. Like the Anakim, they are also counted as Rephaim. Remember, Rephaim means gigantes, the giants. But the Moabites called them Emim. So the Ammonites and the Moabites are descendants of Lot. Lot was given property on the east side of the Jordan Valley. So as his family starts expanding, because families do that, as they grow up, they increase in number and they need more territory. As they grow in number, they come into contact with these giant groups. And they defeat them. And then verse 12 says, the Horites, you know, the cave dwellers, also lived in Seir formerly, but the people of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them before them and settled in their place, as Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave them. So Mount Seir, southeast from the Dead Sea, was once occupied by one of these giant groups. When the Mesopotamians came through around 2100, they defeated them. But then later, during this period, 1700s to 1500s, the people of Moab, or excuse me, the people of Esau, they had to beat up on them and take their property because God had given that property to them. Go down to verse 20 for another parenthetical comment. It says, it is also counted as the land of the Rephaim. Rephaim are who?
Giants.
Rephaim formerly lived there, but the Ammonites called them Zamzumim. Now before that, they were just called the Zamim. So now they're the Zamzumim. A people great and many and tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before the Ammonites, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place, as he did for the people of Esau, who lived in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites before them, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place, even to this day. And so we have these stories from this time period that humans that God had given certain territories to had to take that territory from giant groups that were currently occupying it. And those giants were big. They were bigger than the average human. Now, how big was the average human? Somewhere over 5'9", but probably less than 6'6". How do I know that? Because of the cubit. The cubit later is from here to here, elbow to the tip of your middle finger. 18 inches was typically what was considered a cubit in the New Testament time. And an 18-inch cubit ratioed on an average human body is 5'9". I'm exactly 5'9". This is exactly 18 inches on me. Okay? A 20.7 cubit, which was the old cubit of Egypt, renders a height of about 6'6". So somewhere between there was usually what humans were size-wise. Okay? Giants were bigger than that. Probably because when the angels were monkeying around with things, they tweaked a few aspects of it to make sure that they were bigger. Because, you know, you want them to be bigger. Bigger's better. Next time. This is during the time that Israel was coming into the Promised Land in the 1400s BC. Numbers 13:2 this time is our starting spot. You probably recognize the story. This is when they were sending in the tribe or the spies to check out the land, right? They go in specifically to see what the cities are like and the people are like living in the land. Well, if you remember correct, the report that came back, and I'm going to skip now to Deuteronomy because it's too big of a context to read the whole Numbers thing. So that's there for your benefit to go back and read on your own again. The Deuteronomy 3, if I can get there. The Deuteronomy 3 is actually about on the east side of the Promised Land. You remember that same highway that the Mesopotamians came down? The same place where the Ammonites were fighting against the Rephaim in their day? It reports here that only Og, the king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Rephaim. So by the time of 1400 BC, there was only one giant guy left in that region east of the Sea of Galilee. Now, he might have had kids that were shorter than him, however that works, but he was the last big Rephaim guy. How big was he? Well, behold, his bed was a bed of iron. Is it not in Rabbah of the Ammonites? Apparently the Israelis captured his bed and put it on display in one of their cities. 9 cubits was its length. 9 cubits would be basically 13 and a half feet. Conservative estimate places him probably around 12 feet, because that's why you would need a bed that big, is if you were about 12 feet. Yes, Mary?
So you wonder if they hooked a camel or a donkey up to it and drove it across
the desert? I don't know how they transported it, but they put it on display, and here it is. It's 13 and a half feet by 4 cubits, which is 6 feet. 6 feet wide. Because, you know, when we think of giants in our modern period, we typically think about people who have a pituitary problem. A tumor on the pituitary, or some sort of hormone problem, will make you grow monstrous. But it also shortens your life because you're growing too fast. I don't remember his name, but he was like half an inch shy of 9 feet. That we know, we've got pictures of him, right? He's the tallest authenticated giant, okay? But he was scrawny because he was 22 years old when he died, because his body just couldn't keep up with the pituitary gland problem. The guy before him was, he was 8'7", I think, over in Egypt or Africa or someplace, and he couldn't even stand. He had to be on a cart. Yes?
I'm looking it up for you. I think his name is Robert Wadlow.
Robert Wadlow, is that right?
It said he died when he was 22 and he was 8'11".
Mm-hmm. So, crazy, right? But these guys are humans that had a genetic problem. These guys that we're talking about are hybridized, intended to be that big. And so the reason this bed has to be wide is because this guy is solid. He's not scrawny. Okay? And by the way, it says there, that's according to the common cubit. So that's how we know it's the 18-inch one. Okay? If it was the longer one, he'd be even bigger. Okay? The Joshua 14 it's the finishing of the story of the spies. And this is, it's actually 40 years after the spying project. Because if you remember the story, the spies went in, they saw all the stuff, they came back, and 10 of them go, oh, woe is us, it's horrible. They're so big, we can't take them, oh. Right? And then God says, fine, you can't go into the place, you got to all die off. This whole generation has to die off before I let you go in. So that's how we end up with 40 years in the wilderness. So 40 years later, there's only two of the spies that are still alive, Joshua and Caleb, because they were the good guys in the spies, because they actually said, no, God will take it for us. We don't have to do all the fighting. Doesn't matter how big the guys are. So in Joshua 14:6, it's the time to divvy up the land. So the people of Judah came to Joshua Gilgal. Caleb, the son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, said to him, you know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, in Kadesh Barnea concerning you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses and the servant of the Lord sent me to spy from Kadesh to spy out the land. And I brought him word again as it was in my heart. But my brothers who went up with me made the heart of the people melt. Yet I wholly followed the Lord my God. Moses swore to me on that day, saying, surely the land on which your foot has trodden shall be an inheritance for you and your children forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord my God. Now, behold, the Lord has kept me alive, just as he said, these 45 years, since the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses, while Moses walked in the wilderness. And now, behold, I am this day 85 years old, and I'm still a spring chicken, basically is what he's saying here. I'm still as strong today as I was the day that Moses sent me. My strength now is my strength as then, for war and for going and coming. So now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me and I shall drive them out, just as the Lord said. So basically, Caleb was on that spy detail. And this is what we know from it. They were down to the south. They're off the map here. And they came north, and one of the first regions they came to was this region right here. The region where Abraham and Sarah and all the patriarchs and matriarchs are buried. It's called Hebron today. But at this time it was called Kiriath Arba, because the guy that controlled it at this time was named Arba, and he was an Anakim. He was one of the giants. And he had three giant sons. And when Caleb saw them as they went by, of course, they noted all this down. And when the spies went back, they reported, yeah, the Anakim are in the land, specifically right around Hebron. They got big cities, and they're big people, and we look like grasshoppers to them. Now, that's not just simply talking about size there. Do you know what Middle Eastern people think about grasshoppers? Lunch. Okay? Food source. Now, what is one of the things you know about all the stories of the giants that you hear from the world? They like to eat people. That is a common theme through all of the giant stories. And one of the reasons that humans want to wipe them out is because these giants like to eat people. We can't let that happen. That seems to be part of the story here. So Caleb took note of that. And so he said, I'm going to take that place. And he did. And the story seems to be that some of the giants must have survived, and they headed off to the west, to a place called Gath. One of the other things we know is right here, to the southwest of the city of Jerusalem, and northwest from the city of Bethlehem, there's a little valley. The valley has a name. It's called the Valley of the Rephaim. The Valley of the Giants. And it probably gets that name because there were giants living there at that time. And so the Israelis, when they came through, not just Caleb, but all of the Israelis, when they took the properties, they chased the giants out if they didn't kill them. And guess which direction the giants went? They went westward. And they end up settling over in Gath. Which brings us to a little something from Josephus. For which reason they removed their camp to Hebron, and when they had taken it, they slew all the inhabitants. There were till then left the race of giants, who had bodies so large and countenance so entirely different from other men that they were surprising to the sight and terrible to the hearing. The bones of these men are still shown in to this very day, unlike to any, I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time with seeing this here, credible, what is that next thing, relations of other men. So that's what Josephus reports when he's writing the history here in the first century of the Christian era. He says, yeah, the thing that's been handed down through all the Jewish history years is that when the Israelis came to Hebron, there were giants living there. And they either killed them or chased them out. And some of the bones are still around, and the bones are shockingly large. Now, some modern people object to all these stories of giants. Said, all those people in the past, they were looking at bones of large dinosaurs, and they were interpreting those as human bones. A femur of a large theropod does not look like the femur of a human being. There is a big difference between them. You would not mistake them. And so there is little doubt in my mind that this is an accurate history.
I was also going to say, most of the time when you find bones, you find bones and not just one bone.
Very good. You find bones, plural, and that is true. There have been finds of articulated skeletons that are very large. There are some modern day people that love this particular topic, and so they write stories and they show places where they've got photographs or they've got stories in local newspapers about finds of skeletons that are very large. Usually we're talking about 9-10 feet tall, something like that. And so I think a lot of that is very credible and not fanciful, because the Bible seems to uphold that idea. We've just been looking at some of the stories. We actually have this very famous story that I only have to reference for you. In the time of David, talking about the late 1000s, early 900s BC, David has to fight who? Goliath. Where's Goliath from? Gath, the very place that these giants were running off to apparently several hundred years earlier. And he's not the only giant there. 2 Samuel, 1 Chronicles mentions several other giants that are from the Gath area. And David and his men seem to be devoted to wiping them out. Goliath was just the first one to get it. Now, who here can remember how tall Goliath was? He was about 9.5 feet tall when you convert the cubits. 9.5 feet tall, folks. That's a big dude. Now, Saul was probably 6.5 feet tall, because the average Israeli probably is about my height based on the cubit. About 5'9". And so he was head and shoulders above all of the Israelis. But even if he's 6.5 feet tall, he still only comes up to the belly of a 9.5 foot tall guy. That's pretty scary. And David would have been a few inches shorter than the average Israeli at this time, because he's only about 13. And so he would have only came up to Goliath's waist. And yet he took him down because of God. But the other stories that we're running out of time, so we can't go into, maybe I'll start with them next week, is how David's men wiped out the other giants at Gath. And what we seem to read in these histories is that over time, human activity intentionally took down the number of these gigantes, these giants, these Nephilim, these hybrids that were spawned because of fallen angel activity, and just kept whittling away at them until in the lower Middle East, eventually, there are none left. They are forced into extinction or into moving, migrating. And chronologically speaking, a lot of the giant stories in Europe, Africa, and in North America start popping shortly after the time of David. Because apparently the giants start looking elsewhere for a place for them to carry on their activities. comments or questions on this wild topic for the night that's still related to angels? Were giants involved in the construction of the pyramids? We don't know for sure. We know that the pyramids were constructed in the time before Abraham. So between the time of the flood and the time of Abraham, that's when the pyramids were going up, and we seem to believe that there was some sort of activity of the fallen angels again messing around with the human genome and producing these overly large humanoids. And so, maybe? Don't know.
So is giant DNA still part of
that? Oh, giant DNA, is it still there? There has been some research not too long ago that have said that they are coming across some unidentifiable strands in certain people. It's something that doesn't, it's not in everybody. It's only in certain people, and they're like, where's this from? Now, of course, all the UFO people are going, oh, this is aliens. This is aliens. They've injected their DNA into this place. Well, if you think about fallen angels as being aliens, maybe, because I am not all that far from believing that the angels are still monkeying around. I think they're still playing their games. And this is problematic. And one of the things that we should always keep in mind is that when the angels start monkeying around in this way, it's not very long before God's judgment falls. They do it before the flood comes. They do it after the flood, Sodom and Gomorrah gets smacked. If they're at it again today, next big event is Jesus coming back, which is fine with me. But we'll have to wait and see how that pans out. Yes, sir.
The size of
the mothers has been something that a lot of people want to talk about, because it does seem to be from the text that women are used to incubate these hybrids. What would likely happen to a woman that tries to be used as a container for an overly large baby? She might very well die. Do you think that would matter to those that are trying to get this project done? No. No, they don't care about humans. Humans are just a tool. Humans are just a means to an end. So why would they care? And so, I don't think that really comes into the equation for them. Let's close up for the night, and then we'll pick up next week talking about the other giants that are taken out by David's men, because there's some interesting physiological things that are mentioned in the text that show up in some of the European, African, and North American native stories about giants, and I think we need to bring those up. Okay? Let's pray. Father, I thank you for the chance again to go into your word and talk about things that are kind of out of the ordinary for us to talk about. But we know that it is part of the story of being at war. We know that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against these world rulers of darkness that have hated us from the very beginning of our existence and have always wanted to cause trouble between us and you. And so, Father, we would pray against all of that troublemaking. And we would ask that you would help our brothers and sisters that are in humanity to be freed from their influences, and that we might be able to help advance the gospel of salvation into the lives of the people that need it the most. And we look forward to one of these days, Jesus coming back and all of this being over and us getting all the answers of the behind-the-scenes things. Until then, Lord, help us to be happy with just looking in the Bible and seeing what we can learn. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.